Welcome back to the podcast. Slight technical issue. We'll be back to the good cameras next week. but starting off, I just listened to a Tim Ferriss podcast with Naval Ravikant, which I enjoy doing. I like Naval a lot. First time that I have been interested in NFTs after watching it.
Cool.
Not first time I've heard of an NFT as anything other than an influencer pump dump cash grab to exploit their audience, which was exciting.
Cool.
So I'm not, listen to the podcast if you want to get it all, but between you and I, with the parts that I found interesting. So they talk about web 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. Mm-hmm. 1.0 is live journal and you go on the web and somebody writes to you, you consume it, not a lot of interaction. 2.0 is social media where there's user generated content, much more interaction, but owned by these centralized companies, Facebook, YouTube / Google, Snapchat, whatever. And then 3.0, they talk about the blockchain, which has a lot of the interactivity of 2.0, but owned by the users. Mm-hmm. Like if Facebook were a co-op that you owned based on the value that you brought to the Facebook community. Mm-hmm. So what was interesting is that I think they identified the same thing that pisses me off about NFTs, which is there's a ton of cash grab. But in technical terms, what they say is that it's skeuomorphic, which in Andreessen Horowitz means that people are just trying to take things that exist in the world and like slap it on an NFT and pretend that it's novel. And this is what was bothering me about all the super excitement about Gary Vee's NFT, which is like, dude, you're going to get to go to this thing and only people that have the NFT are going to be able to enter. And if you resell it, you can make money. I was like, that is a ticket. Yeah, yeah. That is a ticket that Gary gets a cut of. And he's like, no. He's also going to do like send you random stuff. Like that is a loot box. Like all of these things exist already. Oh, no. He's going to get on the phone with you. Like that's coaching. That's mentorship. He can sell all of these things. Now you could always, you know, sort of resell those sorts of things. He just gets a cut of the resell. And there's insane speculative value of this conference that no one has been to. No one knows any speakers at, which I thought was silly. But what they talk about, which is cool, and I don't know technically how we get here, but they were talking about like, imagine a world where J.K. Rowling was not incentivized to keep sole ownership of Harry Potter, where she was able to crowdsource new ideas and new entire stories, video games, that kind of stuff, such that, yeah, I see you making a face.
Yeah, sorry. Are you sure this is about NFTs and not about crypto blockchain technology as a whole?
It's about crypto blockchain, but they were specific to... And I don't know the details of which one would be appropriate for it. I'm not a technical person, but they were talking about it with regards to NFTs.
Okay. Because, well, NFT just means non-fungible token, but we can talk about it later. My friend who's deep into studying the blockchain is very hot on DAOs, mm-hmm. which are another use of the technology, which lets you kind of crowdsource a company, mm-hmm. but it has nothing to do with NFTs. Mm-hmm. It's just a token that basically symbolizes your ownership in a company that turns to you when asking what should we expand in, sure. and things of that nature. And so
they mentioned DAOs as well, so I might be confusing it.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Like when you say, and maybe I'm wrong, when you say J.K. Rowling crowdsourcing video game ideas for her IP and everybody who contributes to the idea getting to reap value from having mm-hmm. contributed, my impression is that that's a DAO, which is interestingly something I've heard no one talk about. Like no, and mm-hmm. people are, I'm not, this isn't cutting edge, but like none of the people pumping
cash grabby stuff, yeah,
pudgy penguins,
yeah,
are talking about this stuff. But my friend who went into the blockchain and was studying AI and was just trying to figure out what's the next tech that really changes things, he came out saying DAOs, they're going to be the thing that actually changes the world, and that's what he's been investing in.
So that's, and I don't know if this will ever come to fruition in the way that I'm imagining, almost certainly not in the way that I'm imagining, but that got me excited. The collective ownership of intellectual property, like how many fan fictions, I think what they were sort of talking about, and these are my words, not theirs, is that capitalism has a weird thing where the person who writes the best contract gets all the value, mm-hmm. right? And it's not necessarily who generates the most value in any particular project or the fan who is like telling all their friends and family to get tickets and sets up the fan website. Like they don't necessarily collect the value from that. It's the intellectual property owner who has it always and forever unless they make a foolish decision to sell it at an undervalued price. And this was just the idea of a collectively owned IP where a Critical Role or a Harry Potter could have...
I do wonder how it differs from stock. because you could be a public company. So like, let's say you own a token for a DAO. And because you own it, you own part of the value of it. So you go and start a fan-based website that makes the IP better, that brings in more fans, and therefore the tokens as a whole become more valuable. Isn't that exactly the same as owning equity in a company and doing the same thing for a company, and now your stock is worth more money?
I think part of it is that what these allow you to do are to have contracts that are made instantly, and like contracts. So if you go to this, I'm moving to a different field, but if you were to go to New York and you were to buy a piece of art off of a person, technically they could write you a contract right there that says, look, if you resell this, you will give me 10% of the value. But it's you can't do that. It's not enforceable. It's a pain in the butt. So they just sell it and they don't collect any of the value. I think what these super easy to execute contracts allow you to do is to set up very different incentive structures that become natural to this new economic form.
Still sounds like a world where the person that gets the most value from something is the one that writes the best contract. If it's not a default contract and it really is down to one-to-one, and when I sell my ownership in a DAO or an NFT, I contract with you, aren't we back to the same thing
wins? You can earn ownership. Like, so in order to earn ownership in a stock, I guess you can work the company or you can buy stock. Mm-hmm. You can contribute to these networks in other ways and get ownership. So right now, mining is one of the things that you can do. And I don't know how it will change in the future, but you could raise the profile of a thing, bring in a certain amount of eyeballs, likes, like write the fan fiction that everybody is super interested in participating in.
Sure, and but I mean, if you write the fan fiction that everybody loves, you still get today to make all the money. Because either Twilight or 50 Shades of Grey, I forget which came first. The other's just a fan fiction of the other.
50 Shades of Grey is, yeah.
And that person wrote it, owned the whole thing, and made a ton of money by writing it.
And Twilight made none. So instead, what they would have done is written that fan fiction actually in the Twilight world with, instead of what's his name, Christian Grey, they would have used Edward, and they would have started with that fan base, made a portion of the money, shared a portion of money. You know, so it creates new incentive structures. And I guess the thing that is exciting about that is, to me, instead of having a 50 Shades of Grey and a Twilight, you get a Twilight fan fiction, which is canonical and not just fan fictions, but video games, music, all these kinds of things. You have people with ownership in intellectual property that goes beyond just that company. And the ability to add to it, create, and iterate on it, which only exists inside the company in a very top-down thing where Disney says, we now own Star Wars, this is episode 8, because we say it is. You know, and everybody goes, we fucking hate this. And it's like, tough shit. You're going to wait till episode 9 or the next book. And if anybody tries to write a Boba Fett or this or that and the only thing, we're going to sue the ever-living crap out of you. Disney would be incentivized, the way I understand it, to extend this experimental ownership to the collective, because they would reap some of the benefits of the success of the collective. Whereas now, if you write a Boba Fett fan fiction, Disney takes all or nothing if they don't sue you.
I guess, or just licenses it to you. I don't know. This to me sounds exactly like something you could do without needing a blockchain. So I feel like we've missed the mark somehow.
Well, so you could license it. What this allows you to do is license it very easily to everybody. You know what I mean? So instead of writing,
they don't want that. They don't, because they don't want a bunch of trash content that's technically licensed as Disney.
Yes. So it's not. It doesn't become canonical. And this is the thing: is that the community now becomes the owner. So instead of Bob Eisner saying, "I don't want that trash content," you're diluting the brand. The community tends to owns the brand in this new world, and the communities vote on what becomes canonical based on their interaction with it in some sort of way. So I don't totally understand it. You may be right that it might not work for.
Well, I just think I feel like we missed the mark. I kind of feel like we're looking at the internet being like, oh yeah, this will be like a new encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. And instead of having to look up a word in the dictionary, you'll just type antelope and you'll find out what an antelope is. It's like, no, it's not going to be one-to-one to what you understand.
Well, that's
happens
the point.
In the physical world at all. It's actually going to be this thing called Facebook. And I feel like right now we're describing something that seems very, very similar to what we already have, which makes me feel like we've missed the mark.
That may be the case. The general point that they were doing is, we don't know where we are yet. It's going to change everything. Here's some ideas of how it will. Collective ownership is going to change the incentive structure, and it's going to change the way that people interact with popular things, no longer as a fan separate from it, but as an owner of it, a creator, a potential editor, and it's going to shift the incentive structure, which I just thought was really exciting. And so you're right. It might not, like, we're thinking of these licensing models, and maybe that's not what it is. But just the general idea that people will have, myself, increased creative say, ownership, even if it's 1/1,000,000th of a vote based on my participation in Star Wars, Indiana Jones, whatever. The intellectual property piece of it was like...
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, is that good? Well, is the best art created by crowdsourcing ideas instead of having a couple geniuses work on it? I don't know.
You could still do both. This is the thing. People are like, they say the crypto is going to destroy fiat. They're not into that, or at least the two guys on the podcast, which is Naval and this guy, Chris Dixon. Mm-hmm. They're like, there's space for both. There's space for top down. There's space for bottom up. This is just creating a new opportunity for things that will work in this. But there's some things where you're going to want top down decision making that it will work better. But this is going to create new kinds of opportunities. And that same question, you know, was the Wikipedia question. Like, is it better to have us write the encyclopedia or is it to have everybody? And I definitely would have bet that the smart people should have written it. So surprising that people without a stake in Wikipedia, other than like weird internet points. Second thing, I watched John Oliver on homelessness the other day. We've mentioned this, but I was struck by it. I feel like so many of the conversations about homelessness are just people talking about two different cohorts.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're like,
sure.
He just grabs, you know, this family who was paycheck to paycheck, and then the mom got laid off, and now they're living in their car, and you know, just repeatedly, this is the face of homelessness. This is the face of homelessness. I was like, and we shouldn't treat it with these particular by criminalizing it or this sort of thing. And I'm like, yes, in this particular thing. Where yeah, I live,
the homeless are not a monolith. Not every homeless person has the same story. Not every homeless person has the same likelihood of committing a violent crime. Mm-hmm. It's of course you can't brush the entire homeless population with one brush.
Like. Yes, it's an important piece of the conversation to have. But yeah, it almost, we just need to like split this into several different conversations and stop calling it homelessness, because he was pushing against the mental health crisis narrative of homelessness, which is not the entirety of it. In the area where I lived in Santa Monica firsthand, it's a drug mental health issue. Now, there certainly are people that do not fit that bill, and I'm only talking about dozens or hundreds of people, certainly not the entire scope of it. But firsthand, that is a cohort to which people are referring when they speak about homelessness and when they propose solutions and when they talked about the intractability of the problem. So he concludes with...
Well, yeah, it's kind of like treating the unemployed are all people that couldn't do their jobs. It would be a ridiculous statement. But also to say the unemployed are all people who were excellent at their jobs and laid off for no reason is also stupid. Like some people are unemployed because they were not able to hold down jobs, and others are unemployed because of a series of tragedies that if given another chance, they would be able to excel in a corporate environment. Like, yeah, is he proposing that all homeless people are the same?
Well, no, and I don't want to say that he was, I think he tilted towards, no, he definitely wasn't. But there was one quote that I had, which was, you know, you have to ask yourself, because he's talking about how increasingly homeless activities like being in certain public areas are being criminalized in a lot of cities. And says, you have to ask yourself if the rise in crime in homeless people is just from them sitting down. And I can tell you maybe some of it is, but not where I lived. Like where I lived, it was because they broke into our building on several occasions, stole stuff, you know, busted in the apartment and committed crimes.
Yeah, this like, it's just the anecdotes. It's absolutely an end of one. But yeah, we had homeless people who broke into our building, tried to rob people, broke into cars, threatened people with weapons.
And so the point is, I found myself just saying yes, both. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. So they often, both exist.
Yes, and the question of course is to which proportion, in which area, and that the solution that works for a particular cohort might be ineffective for another cohort of people. And rather than arguing whether it is a mental health crisis or it is his solution, which maybe works for a lot of people, is like just provide them with homes and the problem is solved. It seems clear to me that it is neither of those across the board. And I guess that's not as interesting of a conversation to have. And it doesn't lend itself as easily to solutions. But yeah, the line that they has... in the segment was house keys are the only thing that ends homelessness. And yeah, given my just experience there, I was like, that is not going to take care of what the people in the neighborhood that I used to live in were talking about. Like house keys would very likely not do it. Maybe it would. Maybe that would solve all the problems. But yeah, it was. I just found myself saying yes, both. I also watched some of Jon Stewart on, he's got the thing on Apple TV where he talks about the economy. And I know it's trite to say, but I feel like liberals and conservatives just touch different parts of the elephant and then insist that they're right all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they just like get all of these images of their parts of the elephant. You know, this is the hard back leg and the way that this is a muscle. And somebody's grabbing the trunk is like, no, this is soft and tender.
Of course, you saw that. You saw, during the BLM protests was the strongest case I've ever seen of that, yeah. Where if you turned on one news station would just have a bunch of police beating up just civilians in a horrible fashion that clearly was like a way, way overkill, beating up people in wheelchairs. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then the other would have people flipping cop cars, Molotov cocktailing them, running around with machetes.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of these things were happening across the country. And it was very rare to see someone that had the two images next to each other. You would get six of one from one news station, six of the other from the other. And most people are just living in rural or suburban areas. They're not even close to a real one. They didn't see a BLM protest with their eyes. And yeah. So whatever station they tune into is they just go, oh my God, all of the protests look exactly like this. It's all police beating up people in wheelchairs. They're like, oh my God, it's just a bunch of people Molotov cocktailing cop cars. It's like, whatever narrative you want is what part of the elephant you show people.
Mm-hmm. There was I watched a little bit of, there's the YouTube channel Modern Wisdom. I don't know the guy's name. He does interviews with people. He had David Pakman on. And he, at one point, said, you know, the BLM riots or the this. And Pakman says, you know, I think it's really interesting you refer to it as the BLM riots. I've never heard of it like that, except on conspiracy channels. When I think of riots, I think of January 6th. And as if that was a sufficient point, that he had never heard of it that way. And I was like, dude, you just nailed it. Like, two totally different worldviews by people that were not present in Washington, D.C. necessarily at the Capitol building, nor were they at the BLM overwhelmingly peaceful or the violent parts of the riots, certain that anything that contradicts what they have heard the most from their echo chamber is a conspiracy. It's like, that is the interesting conversation to have, which is, how are you, like, is there a principle? This was what was sort of frustrating me with the riots / protests was, by what principle does something get called a riot? If like the overwhelmingly peaceful, it was like 99% of this was peaceful. It was like, okay, if we apply that to the amount of people at the January 6th thing, and we take all of the people that showed up and all of the people that committed a crime, and it is 99% of the people didn't commit a crime, does that count now as overwhelmingly peaceful? And we've said this in so many different ways, but of course not. There is nobody's interested in like, few people, I should say, are interested in the application of principles evenly to their pet projects and their...
I'm pretty confident that one of them probably was more violent per capita than the other, but I've never seen anybody run any sort of analysis to figure out which. So,
and of course, not all violence is created equal, right? You know, there's different kinds of violence. So like, you might, somebody stealing property versus somebody murdering someone versus somebody breaking and entering. Like, these are not all the same exact types of things. Somebody, you know, issuing a death threat versus doing it, you know? But yeah, it was just, I turned off the interview after that. I was like, it's just going to be partisan for the rest of the thing. We're not going to have the interesting conversation about why are you so certain that the other side is a conspiracy and that your side isn't.
Yeah.
And you just said it because you've never heard it before. That's how we deem what a conspiracy is. Something that I haven't heard often except from the people that I dislike. And I mentioned this to you, I won't go too deep, but I listened to another podcast, Jordan Peterson, I guess it was on Michaela Peterson's podcast, talking to a woman who was an SJW by her own definition and hated Jordan Peterson and described it, you know, why she hated him. She's like, I listened to 30 seconds of you and I didn't like the thing you said and I'd heard about you several times before. And so I was just like, never again will I let that person enter into my brain. So yeah, That's a handful of the things that I've got. I've got one or two more, but what do you got?
I have a bunch of stuff. First, shout out to our unofficial sponsor for this, Mint.com. They aren't paying me to say this, but today Mint.com made me aware that someone stole my credit card. So I wanted to shout it out. I'm not getting paid for this, but everyone should sign up because I got an email. It's like, hey, you have a fee for this withdrawal. And I said, that didn't happen. And it turns out in the last 3 days, someone stole my credit card, physically stole a credit card, and has just been banging it for $1,000 of gas, liquor stores,
and this happened
fast food.
Happened at our last place where we lived, where mail was constantly stolen because people would break in the building and grab stuff.
Yeah, it was a credit card I was waiting to get mailed, and I never received it. So I know that's weird, but it's COVID, and the mail's all been struggling. So I guess it got lost in the ether. Someone found it, and so yeah, Mint.com is the only reason that I know that somebody was using my credit card. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, and this is a card just like that we weren't looking at. It was for the Dungeons and Dragons podcast. It's like we put money in there and haven't looked at it. We're not like
I never got it. I never would have checked because I just thought that it got lost in the mail.
Yeah.
And USPS has been struggling with COVID and labor shortages, and it just was never going to make it to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't occur to me to check that someone else had gotten it and was banging it at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yeah. Well, hope they enjoyed themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it. $1,000 over the last 3 days. I think they're having a great time. Another thing for all the fight fans, Hofthor has transitioned to boxing. Thor, the guy that played the mountain in Game of Thrones. It's pretty interesting. He's actually doing fights. I hope he does a fight. He will get starched by any professional fighter.
Did you watch him?
Yeah.
Have you seen him?
I've watched him fight. He's a great athlete. Let's start there. He's obviously very strong, and I think he's taking it seriously. I don't know what to say except for as soon as a real boxer steps in the ring with him, he's going to get murdered.
You think so?
Yeah.
Even if they're 100 pounds lighter.
No one. Yeah, they won't be is the thing. So he is 345 pounds, which sounds crazy. And when I first heard that Mountain was doing boxing, I thought this is going to be awesome because there is a point where size matters. I think there's a sparring session that went viral where the Mountain Thor, he fights Conor McGregor, quote unquote, and I think he would have murdered him at any moment if he cared to. And this is when Conor was in his prime. And I was like, oh, Conor pieced him up. It's like, no, this gentle giant allowed your hero to survive this sparring session. He could just straight up, like it was Game of Thrones, grab him by the skull and just murder him. And so when I heard he was getting into boxing, I was like, oh, this is going to be sick because at some point, if Shaquille O'Neal gets into MMA, he can win with some training just by virtue of size. And I'm curious to see what that size versus skill differential is. But this guy is actually not that much bigger than a heavyweight boxer. He's 350 pounds, and Tyson Fury's 280 pounds.
Oh, you could be 280 as a heavyweight.
And so at 65-pound difference, I realized this is not as exciting as all the YouTube channels I was watching were making it out to be, and he's going to get starched. Mm-hmm. But he won't. He'll just do freak show fights, and I don't say that pejoratively. He'll do like Logan Paul versus Floyd Mayweather stuff and make a bunch of money, which is sick. But we don't actually get that experiment yet. Which I, as someone who likes fighting, have always been curious. If LeBron at 23 decides he wants to do MMA, is he the heavyweight champion of the world within 6 months?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Like maybe he is. He's 6'8". He's a freak athlete. I don't think we've ever, no offense to Stipe or Francis Ngannou, but we haven't seen a LeBron James in there. And I thought this was potentially that. But
Francis is close.
Definitely not.
In terms of, I mean, when was the first time Francis threw a punch in an octagon?
I don't know.
He was in
Francis
salt mines.
Is great.
Yeah. And so he is an example of a freak athlete who didn't come to the sport until much later in life. And he's incredible.
Yes.
And,
but he's still capped by that need to be 265.
Yeah.
So him versus Shaquille O'Neal at 380.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who knows? I have seen Francis Ngannou pick up Shaq. Shaq says the first time in his life he's been picked up since he was over 15. I like Francis. Francis, just to be clear, trained at my old gym and is my coach and him are very, very close friends. I like him. But one day we will get to see what happens when the guy that was going to be a linebacker in the NFL decides to do MMA instead.
Henner rolls with an NFL player. Have you seen that?
Yeah, the guy
goes easy.
Yes. I was trying to figure out how to say this. Like, I like Henner. I think Henner's an amazing, amazing jiu-jitsu coach. Might be able to win if they were both trying their hardest. But the guy that he's doing jiu-jitsu with is clearly focusing on technique and purposefully not doing what he would do in a life or death fight, which is just bench press Henner off of him because he's gigantic and much stronger and more athletic than he's doing when he's, rolling lightly with his coach.
Yeah.
So yeah, which is interesting. Hofthor's boxing, and I think he's in trouble if he ever tries to do it for real, but he'll probably make a lot of money in the meantime because people want to sign in to watch the Mountain Box.
I understand what you're saying, but you're putting up against Tyson Fury, which is the best boxer in the world, period, when you don't control for size. So, like, he could still beat up heavyweights, which is to say that he's one of the best boxers in the world, probably. You don't think he could be top 30 in the world?
The fight I watched was him fighting the best arm wrestler in the world, which I thought was really brave of the arm wrestler, because you are coming in with the only combat experience that guy had was he's actually an ex-special forces military person from Canada, I think, but clearly had never boxed. And so they're just both in there having never boxed, except one is the Mountain and the other is an arm wrestler. So their size difference is pretty meaningful.
Yeah.
But that when I watched that, that was the fight where I went, well, this isn't, we're not quite at the point yet where we're seeing like giant stud athletes take boxing seriously and work at it for a while. I got some billionaire stuff. I don't know if we haven't really touched on the billionaires, but the U.S. proposed a tax for unrealized gains. That's something the billionaires are really pissed off about, because a lot of times we've talked about this, people who have multi-billion wealth, it's because it's all in stock for companies they created, and so they don't think it's fair necessarily to tax them for that, because it's not like they have the cash laying around. Philosophically, I would be on that side, except then instead of selling their stock when they want to buy stuff, they just take loans out against their stock and thus never pay taxes on any of their wealth, which is kind of bullshit. So it's just an interesting battle that's going on in the news. I don't know if you had a thought on it, but I think it's unfortunate because the not taxing wealth until it's realized makes total sense, except for the fact that everyone who has a ton of wealth games the system because of that rule. And so then you end up in this weird place where in order to effectively tax those people, what you're going to do is hurt all the people in the middle who are investing but not enough to actually go take a loan out on it. And so they have unrealized gains.
So, but would we be taxed?
Yes. This?
I mean, yeah, how would you value our business?
Oh, no, no. You'd just get taxed for anything that you own. Like if you had...
I own Charisma on Command.
You also own cryptocurrency and the S&P 500 and anything else like
that. Well, no, the one that I'm going is, how would you tax me on Charisma on Command? I don't have the money. Like,
well, that's actually an interesting question.
I could sell, unrealized gains, crypto, like I could liquidate that. You know, I could sell it and the gains could, you could tax it. I can't just sell Charisma on Command.
Yeah.
And Jeff Bezos, by the way, can't sell whatever you say he's worth. If you were to try to liquidate his 11% at that value, he can't get it. Like, that's not what it's worth when he tries to sell it at that
value.
Well,
the other thing is if you do want these people to own enough of a stake in the business to still have a say in what happens in the business. But yeah, I mean, I think somehow we need to improve wealth inequality. I still don't understand why we aren't just doing a wealth tax.
It's not taxing unrealized gains. It's definitely not that. As a mechanism, it's too fraught with problems. The answer is NFTs. I don't know how, but
I think it's a wealth tax. Warren Buffett said it. I've been sold on the idea. Just tax everyone 1% of their...
Isn't that some kind of a tax on unrealized gains, though, is a wealth tax? Like, how do you determine my wealth? I own Charisma on Command. What is Charisma on Command worth? What
is minus my net wealth? You'd actually be surprised. I think it literally is like 1% is all you need to do a year.
You still have to calculate what Charisma on Command is worth. I don't... What is Charisma on Command worth?
Yeah, I don't know how they would do it for private business owners.
Dude, the value of Charisma on Command, in my mind, is so volatile. Like, I am constantly of the mindset that it could end tomorrow. And I mean that. Not necessarily tomorrow, but within months, it could be over. Or it could continue. Like, we've also grown 25% a year for several years, and that could continue out. So how do I even begin to value something like that? Also, this isn't... I can't sell stocks in this. We don't have replaceable cogs. Like... what's the value of Charisma on Command if you die or I die? Like, and then do I get that money back when I paid on unrealized gains?
Probably not. It probably doesn't take too big a hit unless we both die.
It takes a hit, man.
Yeah.
But you know, here's the thing. Oh no, because you giving... Where does your ownership or my ownership even go if that happens?
To the other one.
Oh, so that would be great. No.
That's what I'm saying. It definitely wouldn't fall in half. You become a wealthier man if I want to say this on the record in case I go mysteriously disappear. Charlie is a wealthier man if I die, because the business wouldn't fall by 50%.
Got it. Not immediately.
Yeah, you'd have to pick up the slack a little bit.
But. Yes, yes. I'd have to compensate for your absence. This level of wealth inequality creates social problems which you'd like to avoid. But I also think they're not giving the devil his due, which is there is a portion of this wealth inequality which comes from contribution inequality. And mm-hmm. that's not to say that, like, this isn't to poo-poo social supports or better childhood education, but they have that graph of CEO pay or, you know, pay of the rich people and average worker wage, and they were tracking with one another until the 80s and they split off. Part of that is, I'm sure, crappy incentive structures that could be changed and fixed. Part of that is the advent of software, which allows one effective coder to contribute at a level 100,000 times more than a regular person and 10,000 times more than a normal coder. And then that cascades down to people like me and you who can't write code, but now just are not speaking on a stage, but can speak to either 10 people, 100 people, millions of people, depending on how far that message goes. So I don't know. I'm just not on the billionaire anger train as much, because while agreeing with the sentiment that income inequality has negative effects, which we would collectively want to curb and redistribute to some of the people that are on the bottom. But yeah, there's just, I don't know, the billionaires as the problem seems too easy, too populist angry for me to get behind. And I'm sure you probably agree.
Yeah, my biggest thing is I'm just shocked that it's so hard to write a tax code that does what we want, which is to tax people who are insanely wealthy to some degree and solve the wealth inequality thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just genuinely surprised that there's, like, for every rule they propose, there's just so many easy loopholes. I wonder if that's just inevitable, because when you have enough resources, like, if the government's going to take $2 billion from you, it's worth spending $1 billion to figure out how to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the solution is. That's why, like I said, the Warren Buffett one just seems so simple. I'm sure the devil's in the details. But
Elon threw up an interesting tweet, which, again, I don't know his morality, but I think a lot of people feel this way. There was some sort of proposition that if they had $6 billion, they could end. I don't know if it was homelessness.
Oh, I was going to bring this up. Yeah. CNN is such a silly goose. They wrote, 2% of Elon Musk's wealth could solve world hunger, says director of UN Food Scarcity Organization. I think Elon just wrote back, okay, if the WFP can describe on this Twitter thread exactly how the $6 billion will solve world hunger, I will sell Tesla stock right now and do it.
Yeah.
But it has to be open source accounting so the public sees precisely how the money is spent. And then obviously they didn't get back to him, which is weird, because I think he really would have given them $6 billion if they could solve world hunger with it.
I don't know the guy, but it's 2% of his wealth to knock out world hunger once and forever. And what do they mean? Give everybody a cheeseburger today? Nobody's hungry today? Like, So I guess what I'm saying is I broadly am frustrated when the problem is just pushed to billionaires. We've talked about how people are very unwilling to look left on the bell curve. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to say that the people who need to step in and make things more equal are the rich people. I had this sentiment when I was watching the Jon Stewart thing last night, is, you know, it's not fair that I have to pay for healthcare in a country where people have so much wealth. It's not fair that I'm not sure if I'm going to keep the heat on. It's not fair if I'm not sure. And there's just very much, understandably, because this is a human trait, like, what about me? What about me? What about me? But there's not like, hey, I have heat and people in Bangladesh don't, so I'm going to take a portion of my $20 an hour and send it over there. I think if people took the principles by which they argue for the reduction of income inequality in America and broaden that to the human race, and then said, okay, we are all going to send massive portions, and this goes through the middle class, through the lower middle class, into people who are in the poverty level in the United States, because in order to limit inequality amongst humans, we're going to have to talk to those people who, like, literally don't have sanitation or clean water and are dying of river parasites. I think that you would see those principles evaporate, which is...
Or you end up with people draw the line around the U.S. They say we should solve this problem within the U.S. and don't worry about people who aren't in the U.S.
To which I now know to say, okay, why don't we draw that line around our neighborhood? You know what I mean? So why doesn't each billionaire say, I'm going to solve income inequality in my little county? Or like, why is the U.S. the appropriate measure? And the only answer that I think people come back with is because that's the one that gets the money to the people who I want it to go to, but prevents the people that I want it to go to from having to send it to people even poorer than them. When I listen to these, I get it. I understand it. And I like charity water because they give it to people that don't have access to water. And I understand, like, yes, we want the government to tax people more, but I understand the dislike of how the U.S. government spends the money that they get.
Have you been following the strikes at all?
A little bit, just that they exist. John Deere, right?
Yeah.
I know a couple of buzzwords.
It's a couple of Kellogg, John Deere. Do you have any? You haven't looked into them at all?
No.
The one thing I thought was, and I could be totally wrong here, but the one thing I thought was interesting is it's, for John Deere, at least my understanding is there's this pretty massive 2-week strike, mm-hmm. 10,000 plus people, and they were going to cut pensions for new employees, which people didn't like, which I think is actually cool to stand up for because it's employees who do have pensions, just standing up for people they don't know who are coming in who wouldn't have pensions. So that, at least from my understanding, that seems pretty noble. And then the other thing is they were offered a 5% raise, and the new thing that they're thinking about signing today is that was doubled to a 10% raise. Mm-hmm. And then I was just curious, so I looked into it. I was like, how's John Deere doing? And they had the best year ever pre-COVID. Their earnings was at like roughly 3-point-something billion. Then it dipped to 2.8-something billion. And this year they're at 5 billion. They're just absolutely crushing it. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if this, at the bottom, if this negotiation looks fervent and full of turmoil and bordering on violent as it's all these protests. And then on the other end, if they're just negotiating against a guy who's like, yeah, I'm going to give him, I'll give him more than this. I've made $5 billion instead of three. I have so much more even than a 10% raise to give them. I'm just going to try to play this chess game to the best of my ability. Because in my mind, I was like, John Deere, just to be clear, even if this got signed, maybe the pension is a huge deal. And I didn't run math on how much that is. But in terms of a 5% raise instead of a 10% raise to their workforce isn't all of their expenses and their profits are up several billion dollars. Like, I don't know that this is actually going to even really impact them unless their revenue plummets and then they'll have to lay off, well, I guess, 10% more people.
So you're talking about them as a company. I think the decision makers are like a CEO who has a mandate to make as much money as possible. If he does, he keeps his multi-million dollar a year job. If he doesn't, they get someone else to do it for him. And so it's, I think part of the problem is that it's just abstracted layers of people wanting the most from their thing. So like somewhere there's a pension fund that owns John Deere, and what they want is not 4% a year. They want 4.5 or 5 or, like, you know, whatever.
Got it.
And so if John Deere dips below, they sell it.
And this is interesting. You're saying that the entity of John Deere is going to be totally fine giving this 10% raise, but the CEO who makes the decision might get fired and might go from making an incredible sum of money to being unemployed. That's interesting to think about. So yeah, so the entity, if the entity were a conscious being, would go, yeah, this is, I don't actually get hurt from this at all. I had a record profit year, best ever. But the person who makes that decision, if they make it nonchalantly, instead of trying for every dollar, because they have that quote unquote fiduciary responsibility to their public shareholders, they'll get fired for failing to maximize profits.
If they give them a 15% thing without negotiating, they're canned.
Yeah.
They get $0.
That's interesting. That's because when you're the CEO of a public company, you are fired if you don't put profits first. Mm-hmm. That's your quote unquote fiduciary responsibility. That's what your board of directors is in charge of doing, is firing you, amongst other things, firing you if they don't think you're stewarding your public investors' capital to the best of your ability or to the best of the company's ability.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't know if this is, I've got too many broken metaphors today, but it's kind of like if every time you ate a piece of food, it either saved your right hand or your left, they were in competition with one another for resources, as opposed to being, having a sense of being part of the same organism. And that is probably the case for how the CEO feels about $0 or all the money. You know, he's like, look, I can give up a little, but I need to keep my job. Like if I don't keep my job, it's not just a little out of my pocket.
And in that case, that's interesting because in that case, it is a bunch of people negotiating for survival at the bottom.
Yeah.
And one guy who feels like he's negotiating for survival at the top, but not survival of the company, which will be okay, but survival of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because his job actually is on the line in a way that the company, they're actually not, it's not life or death for the company.
If collective investors in pension funds and hedge funds all decide, you know what, we're okay with 3%.
Yeah, we don't care about profit.
In fact, we care about workers. And so we're going to have metrics that are sophisticated, not just like one little check mark that right. like, how are your workers doing? Are they happy, et cetera? He'd ease off of it immediately.
Yeah, so he's actually just the symptom of the mandate from all the people that own John Deere.
And by the
stock.
Way, and this is my point.
Is John Deere like, public? I think it must be 100%. Because it has earning. Yeah, it has earning reports.
And so, and where does that come from? It's like literally the evil in every human heart, which is simply, do you participate in systems that you do not understand and try to reap the most from them? Like, do you like the taste of your food regardless of where it comes? You know, when you negotiate with the contractor, somebody who's doing work for you, do you try to give them a little extra to make sure their family has it? Or you try to find the best price or the best value, which is what everybody does, except with friends and family. And
yeah, it's actually, and that's funny because what you try, normally the pattern, unless it's like backbreaking, is that you'll try to find and you'll negotiate and you'll look out for yourself until mm-hmm. you get to know the person, until mm-hmm. the person's in your home installing your electrical equipment mm-hmm. and you talk to them and you find out their background. And then at that point you end up tipping above what you negotiated because mm-hmm. you feel for the person and you're like, oh, this person needs this more than me. Mm-hmm. At least that's the pattern I feel like exists.
So yeah. So what is, it seems that the, you know, what you have are these layers of abstractions that allow people to be their most selfish versions of themselves without literally a thought about mm-hmm. it. Like when people, here's what's happening.
Well, they look out for themselves. So they sell, this is what's funny is they own the John Deere stock. The John Deere stock isn't performing well. It doesn't have a high enough dividend. So they sell it. So they sell it. Just they're like, oh, this stock isn't doing well. I'm going to sell it. And then that selling pressure creates pressure from the board of directors to the CEO that says, hey, you got to get this stock back up or else you're fired. And so then he goes, okay, well, I'm not going to give people mm-hmm. the biggest raise possible because I'm going to get fired.
And what could prevent that sort of decision-making? If they tell the CEO, hey, we're going to fire you unless you screw your child or your wife or your whatever. And he would go, no.
you know? Might screw his wife. I mean, depending on what definition of the word.
But no, and so that seems to be the question is in a $7 billion or plus things, how do you get people to care more about others?
Yeah, to hold the stock when it's going down because you like the decisions that led mm-hmm. to the less profitability mm-hmm. that led, oh, it's not, my dividend is non-existent because they paid their workers well, because they sourced more expensive equipment.
I mean, this is like the dad that goes to Disneyland to watch his kid be happy. You know, it's like, he doesn't like Disneyland. He thinks Dumbo is a stupid ride. He doesn't like 45-minute waits. But he likes his kid being happy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, how do you have sources of joy and happiness that extend outside of your own skin bag? And so we have examples of that, which is friends and family. And I think even some small businesses can hit that.
I also wonder, how many, this is actually really fascinating to me now. I wonder how many people laud the strikes and sell their stocks. I wonder if they're, right hand doing this and with the left hand doing this. You know what I mean? They're like, this is great. And then when John Deere does it and it starts to underperform, they sell the stock. Like they're contributing to the thing that they think they're against, but they don't connect the two.
When they go to a store to buy tractors and they see that the price of the John Deere tractor has gone up 10% in order to accommodate everybody and make more money. And now they're getting a 20% wage and it's going to them. He goes to a different brand.
Yeah, exactly.
The one that does more for less.
It's fascinating.
The roots of these problems, and this is, I guess, what I was trying to say poorly before, is that I hate that we draw the line at billionaires and go, there's the problem. It's their selfishness. It's like, no, every single transaction that you participate in exemplifies the same problem, just an order of magnitudes larger.
Yeah, I'm going to outsource this a little bit because I think it's fascinating. I'm going to turn to our listeners. Can you please comment any brands that you think are ethical? Like the one I always quote, even though I could be wrong, is Patagonia tends mm-hmm. to, it seems like, care about their sourcing and their quality and this and that. I'd love to just have a list of companies where it's like, okay, this is where I'm going to get my clothing. This is where I'm going to get my computers because it's more expensive, but it doesn't involve cobalt mines.
They're private.
Yeah.
Because if you're public, you introduce that level of abstraction.
No.
And now the ultimate bosses do not feel or see the other stuff. And so Patagonia, I don't know if it's true. I read the book. they've got the lifetime guarantee. And he's like, I think it's wrong that people should have to buy more than one jacket. You know what I mean? If you buy a jacket, we should fix it forever. Is that the best way to make a ton of money, even though it's good for reputation? Probably not. Like, seems like planned obsolescence with his iPhone's working out pretty well for Apple, you know? Yeah.
What if we just purposefully made our stuff fall apart after 2 years? Yeah. I bet the guy that came up with that in a meeting got such a fat congratulations for it.
And so there's all this like, oh, it's good for business. And it's like, no, it's not as good for business. You know what I mean? Like, are there reputational benefits? Certainly. Can it be a competitive edge? Certainly. Is it the best way to maximize profits is to do the ethical thing? No, that's the whole damn point.
No, I'm positive Patagonia doesn't make the most money of any clothing brand.
So,
but I'm just saying, if people listening have any other suggestions for ethical companies, let me know. Because I would like to start speaking with my dollars more just to try to be the change I want to see in the world.
Well, I was talking about this, and it's like, it's tough because depending on the day, I'm more in tune with this or not. But so we have our COO, Ivan, who's super into investments, and we've given him money. And I asked him, I said, what are you going to invest in? He said, Alibaba. I was like, dude, isn't that just the CCP? Aren't we just like
funding the CCP
at this point? He's like, dude, it's so undervalued. And I asked a couple, I was like, that doesn't seem like the right thing to do, you know, even if it is undervalued. And granted, if you have an argument for me that like, no, it's not the CCP, or yes, it is the CCP, and that's good for the world because I'm amenable to that. I don't want to just say that the CCP is evil.
I got you covered, dude. I've lost thousands investing in psychedelic stocks so far. So I'm funding what we want and losing money at a rapid rate.
Well, that's it. It's these levels of abstraction. You know, money allows you to extend your tendrils into the world and influence people without knowing about it and pay for people to do certain jobs. And it's like, am I just funding some guy developing the next social credit score at Alibaba where they track all of their citizens? And if you're a weak, like, is that where my gains are going to come from in this particular investment? So, I asked him three times. He's like, it's undervalued.
Yeah.
I'll give him a call after this.
Yeah, I don't think I own anything like that.
Oh, I'm sure we do. I'm sure you do. Like, do you know everything about all of the businesses that you've...
No. Sorry, I'm just lazy. I don't own a lot of individual names. Mm-hmm. I think AT&T is like the only one. So if AT&T's...
What do you own? Do you own diversified...
Yeah, I just own...
There you go,
ETFs.
Man. There you go. What's in that ETF?
Who knows? Yeah, that I have no idea.
What's in that mortgage-backed security? Are we, you know, like nobody knows.
Yeah.
And so it's reasonable to be like, I can't deal with that. I can't be, I can't track the result of every dollar that I spend. So yeah, I don't know how, it seems like what you need in order for this problem to be solved, quote unquote, once and for all, is a raising in the level of consciousness such that people feel more connected to the whole. And I look at the body and the family as examples of units of disparate cells.
Some families
that make responsive decisions for the good of the parts and the whole at the same time and are making these trade-offs and are incentivized to do that in a way that is sustainable. Anything else?
Yeah, I don't even know how to intro this, and I don't want to be insensitive. I was going to because I have a dark sense of humor, but let's talk about suicide powder. So a Dutch psychologist had an interview with a newspaper, and he said he gave suicide powder to more than 100 people, and that he was speaking out in an effort to provoke debate in Netherlands about the laws on assisted dying.
Mm.
And this Dutch psychologist had a loved one who had... a horrible case of, I believe it was dementia. I apologize if I get that. I didn't write down all the details, but he basically saw someone just like technically living, but living out a life of confusion and pain that he thought was that they would have opted out of if they could. But Netherlands doesn't have assisted suicide or the ability to help someone like that if they're physically in pain or anything like that. So he sold suicide powder to people if they wanted to have a pain-free way to opt out of existing, and then came out on it, even though it's a crime, because he's trying to push forward what he thinks is positive change, which is the ability for people who are physically or mentally agonizing in a way that there seems to be no end for, to just be able to opt out. I think probably skewing to the elderly. At least that was my impression of what he was doing. And I think that's interesting issue. So I was curious if you have a opinion on it.
I've often thought, and I don't know anything about this particular guy, I think that behavior can be heroic. Like, to put yourself, I think life can become prison for some people. And to put yourself in front of the law to break someone out of jail, I think is like, not, I'm not saying this particular guy, I don't know the details, but can be a really heroic and selfless act.
Yeah, the super tricky part is that I think a lot of people are suicidal in a moment and then come out of it
and
are incredibly grateful that they didn't succeed or that they had nowhere to turn for an easy, guaranteed, painless out. And so my thought is, I think in the right circumstance, there's a place where it makes sense and is moral and ethical. And at the same time, it's incredibly dangerous because most, I think, people with suicidal ideations don't commit suicide and end up very grateful for that fact. And so the question is, well, how are you going to buffer this such that it's only getting to people that are, for instance, like in daily physical agony from a degenerative disease that there is no cure for?
Well, I understand, but we also have guns and bullets, and we deal with this problem already, which is it's really easy to kill yourself. It is not a challenge. I don't know that suicide powder would at all increase the likelihood that it happened. In fact, I could see it only helping those people that were like invalids or elderly, et cetera.
No, I think societal acceptance is what would increase it. I think a lot of times suicide, there's a guilt to it and a shame to it. And
you think it's society or to the loved ones, though? I don't know, but I would imagine to your loved ones.
I think it's to your loved ones, but I think it's, I mean, I could be wrong. We could bring on someone who's much more of an expert of it. I think it's probably to your loved ones, but I think it is something besides the fact that it's difficult to physically pull off prevents it.
Yes. And 100%. I think it's your loved ones and what they'd have to deal with. I don't think it's the government says it's legal and people have a thing.
Well, maybe what you could have is loved ones signing off on it. Because for this guy, what he's talking about is the elderly. So you could just have someone's, whatever their closest kin, basically come in and just be like, we support this person's decision.
I actually think I would not want that to be the mechanism. I actually think, I don't know if it's a time delay or what, but it should be your own sovereign right to end your life. It is. You like it or not. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no stopping it.
Right now, and thank God for that. I'm not a religious person. It's just a phrase I use. So I really think it should be legal. I've thought about that. I've thought of being in a situation where I was an invalid in a hospital, and I've like, what a burden to whisper to the person that loves me, to whisper to you, be like, Ben, kill me. Like, I don't mean paralyzed. I mean like suffering in pain, trapped inside my body in a way that was torturous.
Maybe you don't know this. I had a extended family member who, I think I talked to you about this. He had a degenerative spine issue that was causing him excruciating pain. He was living in an assisted living facility and eventually just stopped eating. So he's like, I'll just the pain of starving to death for 2 weeks beats the pain of doing this. He was 90 something, I think. I don't want to get the age wrong because my mom watches and constantly tells me I got the details wrong, but we'll say 93, rough guess. And yeah, he just went, all right, well, I'm just going to stop taking my meds and stop eating.
That's a messed up legal system.
Yeah.
That's so messed up.
Well, he was in a facility, so I think would be hard. Like, he's not getting
a gun. because everyone there would, I bet you so many of the people would be like, if it were up to me to go deliver this pill to you, I would do it in a heartbeat, except I'd go to jail. You know what I mean? And the rest of my life would be ruined. And I thought, like, what a horrible position to be in if I'm on that table or somebody asks me. And I thought, what if somebody that I loved asked me? And I knew they meant it. And I knew this wasn't a fleeting thing. And they're in a horrible position. Like, do I have the guts to do that for them and then suffer the consequences? It's like, it's a horrible, horrible system that we have. And I absolutely think that you need to be legally able to assist someone ending their life. And of course, there need to be protections to prevent people who just broke up with their first girlfriend from taking suicide powder, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's not to limit any of life's pain, but there's certainly times where people are ready to go and can't facilitate it themselves. So yeah, I'm a pro of that being introduced.
Well, I thought you'd have an opinion on it. That's why I brought it up.
Strongly pro. Anything else?
No, I can't edit that. The rest are not time sensitive.
Nice. Also, one thing that we have not yet mentioned, you guys might start seeing, we're going to be moving the clips to a new channel. The reasoning behind that is because that's what the biggest podcasts do, and rather than treat ourselves as a small podcast, which we currently are, and like gathering as much views as we can on this one channel, we want to dress for the job we'd like to have, you know, which is behave as if we were planning on having a separate clips channel with tons of views and this podcast to keep things more simplified rather than bombarding you guys with clips, which you may have already seen. So this is the podcast channel where you can, you know, it's going to be new full-length podcasts, and the clips channel, which we'll throw in the link below, is where you might like to sign up if you just want to pop in for a certain topic or something like that.
So, yeah, my sense is they're different consumers. And so some people want to see the full podcast, and spamming them with clips on their YouTube homepage is unnecessary. They don't want the clips. And other people just want the clips. And so this is meant to tailor your experience so you get what you want. And if you like both, you subscribe to both.
Cool.
And put your notifications on either way.
Yeah, please do. It'll help us kick off the channel. It means a lot. It means a lot to the success of that channel and the AdSense and all that kind of stuff. So if you're interested in the podcast, think you might want clips, click the link below, check that channel out, subscribe.
And if you hated the clips, congratulations.
They're
gone.
You'll
never see them again on this channel. This is full episodes now.
What do we got from the audience?
First one is, you were talking about being happy with very little money, but then also saying retiring with $3 million in safe investments after years of inflation isn't that great. Surely it's more than enough on that basis. Do you think the advice to invest passively over time is the wrong advice for the average person?
Well, there's a couple of things in there. So,
good question though. Interesting question.
Yeah. So, being happy on a little bit of money, and then I don't know in what context I was talking about it, or if I was just saying that inflation makes it not a ton, or what was left over. But I'll answer the final question. So, what can you remind me what it was, Justin? Do I think?
So, well, it was kind of, I don't know if it was like an actual question or like a rhetorical one, but they were saying that you had talked about being happy with little money, but then also saying that retiring with $3 million in safe investments after years of inflation isn't that great. And then they said that surely that's more than enough on that basis.
Oh, that's enough if you don't need a lot of money.
Yeah.
It very well maybe. I suppose the inflation rate would be important at that point, because I don't know how much $3 million is in 50 years. And do I think that safe investments are right for most people?
The advice to invest passively over time is the wrong advice for the average person.
I think that one thing that I've learned, and I made this mistake, is when I read the 4-Hour Workweek, I thought everyone was supposed to be an entrepreneur. I was like, everyone needs to go out. And I still think that I would like more people exposed to that opportunity so that they could give it a try, especially in their younger years. I don't think that there is an average person. I think... we could maybe say most people. I imagine that probably investing passively is going to be what's better for the majority of Americans, but I don't know that that makes any particular person average. What I would recommend most of our podcast listeners do, given what I know about the rough demographics, is try to invest in yourself at some point in your life, which means try being a contractor, try starting your own business, give it a try, because that's the investment that you have the most control over, though it's still imperfect. And if you do wind up not going that route for whatever reason, I think it probably makes sense to still invest over the course of your life, though I'm not an expert, but it does seem that cash is not deflationary enough in order to hold compared to like assets or something like that.
Well, I think the bigger question was, if you are a proponent of not needing a lot of money to be happy, like Costa Rica living, a mattress that's not crazy, twin sized, whatever, rice and beans every day. $3 million is 100 years of $30,000 a year, right? So if you're retiring at 62 with $3 million and you have adopted that mindset, how do you marry these two ideas that you don't need more than rice and beans and you need more than $3 million?
You don't need to take, in my experience, extravagant vacations, buy luxury items, have the latest technology, and in order to be happy. In fact, in my experience, those things contribute very little to it. If what you have at the end of your time is enough to do the other things, great. but you still probably want healthcare, solid food, freedom to spend time with friends and family and to not have to live in an area that is super far away from them. But if whatever the inflated value of $3 million and affords that, great. You'll probably be solid.
So this is a weird thing. When people get wealthy, they get bigger houses, bigger yards. When I picture the Costa Rican family, I kind of picture everybody more on top of each other. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's, do you think there's something to that? Like, do you think that having your parents closer to you in proximity, having your siblings closer to you in proximity, when everyone has kids, all the kids are next to each other. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is important? Do you think that's important for some people? Do you think that, like, what, because when I picture what you're describing in Costa Rica, yeah. I do picture a much physically tighter community than like a 2-acre yard and a drive or a 5-minute walk even.
It was tight.
To your friend.
Fewer bathrooms per person, sometimes multiple people in the same room, entire family in the same sort of little.
Sounds quote unquote worse in the sense it's like, everyone's on top of me. I can't get away. You know, I don't have that privacy. I don't have that big yard. But then at the end of the day, that's the, in my, and maybe I'm just wrong. When I hold up that like minimalist ideal of what people are describing when they're trying to say wealth isn't the key to happiness, I do picture that family that's all on top of each other with, you know, your kids playing with your brother's kids, playing with your sister's kids, playing with your neighbor's kids.
I want that, but with space, I will say.
This is my question actually, is space antithetical to that? But we get confused.
I think in some ways it is, because if you look at the societies that have it, they're the ones that live on top of each other. Yeah. And then you look at us, we're these little atomized suburban homes. But so one thing to this question is that my need for space and the effect on my happiness has evolved over time. So when I was 19 and like had no space, sharing a twin size bed, no back pain ever, like that was like fine and exciting. And, it put me in contact with a lot of different people all the time. And there was always stuff going on. And I enjoyed that. As I have gotten older, I don't know if this is subject of getting older or changing independently. Space has contributed increasingly to my happiness. One of the reasons I'm excited to have the place that I have is because I can have people visit and they can stay for weeks at a time in a very much closer space than they would be if they came to visit and stayed at a hotel or something. Cause I have a spare bedroom. Yeah, I do think that there's value to that. And I'll let you know more as I have more and more people stay and come and visit. But I that's something I'm excited for, is to be older and spend time with family and friends close, but with my own room. That's something that I have am unwilling to say is a simple luxury. It has been incredibly valuable for me for the microdosing and for all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. I've told my parents I want to get a little casita. I want to get a house and then put a little house beside my house and have them move into it. Uh-huh. And I would see them every day, which is, you know, everyone likes their family. I'm not saying that is the way. I just picture, when I picture that Costa Rican thing, which we all hold up when we saw the, they are the number one on the happiness survey, you know, like internationally, they're scoring so well. And the anecdotes that you have, it is much more on top of each other. And then
it's what you're identifying is it's generations. It's multiple generations on top of each other.
Grandparents are involved. And then what we do, at least in the US and where I grew up, is we, you know, have big houses and big plots of land and we hang out with our parents and we see our extended family occasionally.
Yeah. And so there's the value of the US is it allows the brother and sister to not have to move to the same neighborhood. Like you can go, I can go to California. My sister can stay.
My sister lives in Tennessee.
Yeah. And so it allows for a different individual expression, which is great. But I think that what I hope to do in my really fortunate life is to marry them and to have enough resources to be like, hey, I found the good spot. Everybody come to my good spot and let me tell you why it's the good spot and have enough space, you know, rooms, whatever, or casita.
Yeah.
That would afford multiple people. But yeah, I think that there's something to that. I'm going to hopefully test it out.
Next is, hey, Charlie and Ben, I've got a female friend who touches me a lot and cuddles up to me a lot at parties we both go to. I don't believe this to be either friendly or sexual, but rather her being possessive of me. I don't want to be friends with her anymore, but I also don't want to discourage her from going to the same social circles as before. Should I make a scene and tell her that I don't want to be friends anymore or just go away / remove her hands when she gets touchy?
Can you just ask her to not be touchy? Like it's, I don't know if what the, I got a dog here trying to lick my face. I don't understand why you don't want to be friends if it's separate from the touching. If you're, if it, so there's two scenarios. One, there's a person I don't like and they're touchy. And the second is, I have a friend who I would like if they were less touchy. Mm. So if you have a friend that you would like, except that they're too touchy, I would just say, hey, when we're out of parties, can you be less touchy? It makes it hard for me to talk to the women I'm interested in flirting with because they think that we're an item or whatever it is that is actually your thought process.
Because makes it much softer and nicer, I think. Because like as definitely. I was listening to you say, I was like, oh, that's tough. And it's like, oh, as long as there's, as soon
you got
to
throw in what the reason is.
Yeah, yeah.
Throw, this is the the classic, I think it was Cialdini put it in Influence. Yeah,
can I stand in front of you because I need copies?
Yeah, there's a copy machine, and when you just walk up and say, hey, can I cut you in line? People say yes 55% of the time. But if you just walk up and say, hey, can I cut you in line because I want to make some copies? For some reason, that jumps the yes
to 93%.
Rate. Even though it's like, obviously you want to make copies.
Obviously I want copies.
So yeah, so when you're talking to her, you could just say, hey, I also don't know. Do you dislike when you're watching a movie and she leans her head on you? I genuinely don't understand what you don't like, but I would just explain. You could, if it's all of it, you could also say, hey, I know you're really touchy. I want to be your friend, but could you be less touchy because whatever, it makes me
think that you're hitting on me.
It makes me feel weirder about the friendship. I don't know. I really don't understand. Hope that's helpful.
Dope.
All right, last one is, my girlfriend of 3 months, 16 years old, is struggling with her dad having control issues, mainly interfering in our relationship and being overly strict when it comes to her freedom. She has to be home by 9 p.m., no phone after 10, can't talk on the phone with me over a certain amount of time. He decides how much time we can be together in a week, and he will take away her privilege to talk with me indefinitely. While I know she's still young, I can't help but feel like we shouldn't have to put up with so much, especially since he seems to be all right with us dating. I struggle to not feel like I should push for more freedom from her or for her, but I know that would only make things worse. Am I wrong in my feelings, or is there something I can do to get us more freedom?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it sucks to be young. It sucks to have people in charge of what you can and can't do. I remember it. I have dreams about it. I wake up in a sweat thinking that people have control over my life like they did in middle
school.
It also serves
a purpose because your judgment is off sometimes when you're a teenager, and I'm not saying this instance, but like you need bumpers so that you don't do something crazy that you'll regret forever.
I have a question of this. Do you think that this would be a potentially useful ball and move? I actually think a 16-year-old that has the guts to calmly an adult speak to a father is very, for many fathers, very attractive in a boyfriend. If he were to say something, you know, while you're over a house, be like, hey, Mr. C, could I talk to you? I know that, you know, you're not comfortable with whatever Julie talking to me after 9 or 10 p.m. And I just wanted to ask if that's because you don't trust me or something. And I just wanted to...
I'd way rather it come from my daughter.
Yeah.
Than some... I mean, they've been dating for 3 months. Have I talked to this kid 6 times?
Oh, he might
come tell me how to be a dad.
No, he's not telling you. He's asking. I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. I personally, I'd find it much more persuasive to come be a conversation with my daughter, who I hopefully have a long history of mutual respect and love with. Mm-hmm. And if she wants more freedom, she should present to me.
So I don't know what things are like nowadays, and I don't know where you live, but I can say if you are 16 years old and your parents are telling you at what time you can and cannot talk on a phone or to whom you can talk, that would have been excessive when I grew up. Like,
I don't know. Depends when school is. If he's like, hey, I'm going to take away your phone because if I don't, you talk to your boyfriend until 4 a.m. and then we have to get up at 6 a.m. to go to school and you're tired.
You had a bedtime? I didn't have bedtime at age 16, man.
I don't know, but I'm saying imagine. It depends. This is the thing. It depends what the daughter's default behavior is. And maybe there is a better way to do it.
It seems excessive. Okay, so, and this is a very personal thing. This isn't a right wrong. If at 16 years old, my parents were enforcing bedtimes, I mean, at 16, you and I were like driving around in cars with our fake wannabe girlfriends and like chasing deer. You know, can you imagine having... There was like a be home by 11:30 type thing.
Yeah, I don't remember. Well, I don't remember, but I'm...
But that's not 9. That's not... Like, they weren't like, oh, don't... You're going to be sleepy for school. It was like you were... That was your own problem if you were sleepy for school at age 16.
Yeah, but I also got straight A's. Like, what about if your daughter's getting C's and was getting A's before she met the boyfriend?
Oh, that would be a completely different situation.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know any details here. So it's like, he seems controlling. I don't know. What are you guys doing? Like, has she started doing drugs since she met you? Is she still getting straight A's? No, but you get what I'm saying. Like, the response, this response is totally different depending on what the last 3 months have been like.
I'm buying this person's frame, which is implicit and having not mentioned any sort of breakdown, that he's a controlling dad. and he is more controlling than most, and where he, you know, he has not come in if negatively impacted this girl's life, which could be wrong. You know, maybe he's not telling us. He's like, ever since I got her addicted to Xanax.
or he just thinks high school is not important. He's like, who cares if she's getting C's? Yeah, I don't know any of the details here. But personally, I'd say, for me, definitely I would rather have this conversation with my daughter than the boyfriend. And so I would think the boyfriend's best chance of being persuasive is to talk to his girlfriend, see if she agrees, and to the extent that she does agree, help her come up with a persuasive way to talk to her own father. Mm-hmm. That's my sense. I mean, your sense can be that'd be cool to go talk
to. Oh, I don't know. That was a question. Here's the truth, man. I don't, 16 is so far away, as is being a father. So this is one of the harder questions you could have asked me, because I'm much better if you're like, I'm 20 to 40. Those and
yeah, well, you know. I can get this at the high level. Just at a high level, like, what does the dad want? Mm-hmm. Probably his daughter to be healthy, happy, functioning well in society, and successful in his definition of successful. So to the extent that someone could ameliorate his stress around his daughter having a phone and staying up past 10 or whatever, and that the dad were convinced that removing those constraints would lead to a daughter who was doing well in school, being happy, not going down a bad path in life, whatever it is, he's going to be okay with it. So at a high level, persuasively, you just think about, what does the dad want? Why is he making these rules? How can I help persuade him to have conviction in the fact these rules are unnecessary, and maybe even getting in the way of achieving that? Mm-hmm. That's how you would.
Or to get him more of what he wants, and a happy condition being the relaxing of the rules or something like that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, just think about from that. What does the dad want? And then be like, okay, how can I get him convinced that these rules aren't achieving that, they're actually in the way of it, or releasing them wouldn't get in the way of what he wants, and somehow he can actually get more of what he wants. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's scared he's losing his daughter, and so she can say there's some, you know, some activity or time they can spend together that would continue to make their relationship strong, that would make him feel comfortable, that he could release the reins a little. I don't know. I don't know the dad, you or the girlfriend, but that's the best way to be persuasive, is just think, why is he doing this? What does he actually want? His end goal in life isn't his daughter's screen time on the phone, you know? So That's your high level best route.
Cool.
Go about that however you think is going to be effective.
Mm-hmm. Hey everyone, this is Justin cutting in from the edit. Sorry about the mic quality. I don't have any of the fancy equipment at home, but I wanted to let you all know that this next question was taken from our Patreon Q&A, which we release once a week on our Patreon. If you're interested in hearing the full episode or more like it, then find the Patreon link in the description.
So next one is, I don't have any motivation to pursue goals since every successful person, including you guys, tells me it won't make me happy. Chasing money, girls, or a dream and achieving it will give you a dopamine spike for a second, but that's it. After that, you feel exactly the same way you felt before. That's what everyone says.
Yep.
Apparently, the way to true happiness is just being content in the present. I know that and can logically understand it, but as of right now, just being with myself, with all that spiritual clarity and anti-materialism, also doesn't make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Is the chasing dream stage just not something you can skip? It feels like a waste of time knowing what's ahead. I also don't have anything I genuinely enjoy or would like to pursue out of pure fun. And on a side note, I'm pretty sure I'm not clinically depressed or anything like that. I'm not sad or lonely. I still experience every emotion a normal guy would have. I'm just bored to death with life, and I don't want to fall into nihilism. Or maybe all that is just an excuse to be lazy and just watch Netflix all day. I really don't know anymore. I'm about to travel the world in 2 weeks as a last resort, with the first stop being France. Hope you guys got some advice.
Well, it's interesting from my perspective, because I think it's not a bad takeaway to say, well, you guys and every other rich person says, oh, money doesn't make you happy. Sleeping with 1,000 women, that's not, you know, it's feels hollow, or it's like eating candy or whatever. So because of you guys, I'm not going to pursue it. But then the subsequent thought I would have thought is like, because all of you at the end of the day talk about how it's about this peace and contentment and such, so I've started a 2-hour-a-day meditation practice, or started doing psychedelics, or like, I actually personally think you can pursue either mountain, because it sounds like you haven't done either one yet. So I think I genuinely think there's value in going out, trying to conquer the world and become charismatic and make a bunch of money and make your dating life incredible and build a bunch of great friends. And it's fun. And also I think it's not all hollow. Like I do think your relationships and a certain quality of life are additive, even in the face of hedonic adaptation. Or if you're saying, I'm going to skip the first mountain, to climb the second mountain. That's different than just skipping the first mountain. And so it's like, okay, if you are going to try to live a enlightened monk's life of austerity, but contentment, there is work that goes into that for most people, unless you have an Eckhart Tolle, just random moment of enlightenment sitting on a bench. It's all the meditation and monk training that goes into that. I think that's why people like Jay Shetty go to monasteries for 3 years. So you pursue either mountain. I think neither will lead you astray, but...
Well, they can, but...
based on this question for this person, I think. Yeah, both can lead you astray. That's fair. But yeah, I think to pursue neither mountain and you're currently dissatisfied with that path, I would say that's not the prescription. Like, I'd only say, if you said, I'm pursuing neither mountain, but I'm just extremely happy and content, and I feel like I've already reached enlightenment, it's like, okay, maybe you got that Eckhart Tolle sitting on a bridge or a bench moment. But yeah, if you don't like where you're currently at, pursue one of the mountains.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Well, yeah, tough to give advice on this because my most recent experience was just very, it's all good.
Like, well, you did psychedelics. That's pursuing the second mountain. You went and sat.
well, I guess, so it wasn't just that. It was, I don't want to talk too much about that as regards this, but the one thing, it was also a recognition, like, whatever you're doing is going to take you where you're going. So your boredom is going to take you there just as fast as your activity is.
Yeah, some people, which you could, in an enlightened state, you'd say that's okay too. Mm-hmm. Some people's path has been laden with boredom and unhappiness and looks like it's going to continue to be a life of boredom and unhappiness. Yeah. And you can respond by saying, well, that's okay. There's nothing inherently spiritually superior between happiness and unhappiness. But if someone's living it and going, I'm not really enjoying this, then I would say, yeah, like,
mix it up.
Pursue happiness in that case.
You've
also done a lot of work in the first mountain. You know, did this person say their age?
No.
They could be the early 20s and haven't not yet tried to do self-improvement or do, you know, anything. Maybe they could have just graduated college recently.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit different than being 34 and having done 100%. All the previous work.
Totally different. Totally different. Yeah. One of the mistakes that I think I make and a lot of people make is they're like, well, if it's not valuable in the final analysis, then it's not valuable today. And that's kind of like being like, you know, the things I learned in first grade aren't deeply true, or the way that they taught me physics in 11th grade with no friction is not true, so it was useless. It's like, no. Like, first grade is great. It's foundational. Like, 11th grade is great. It's all there. So if you're in, you know, wherever you are, and you're going, oh, all these rich people told me that these pursuits weren't going to make me happy, I'm not saying that you have to do it, but if there's part of you that's, like, curious, it's like, yeah. Go ahead and try to get big and strong or make money or
it sounds whatever. Like this person has no curiosity or drive to do anything. Am I reading this right? Like, they don't want to get money, they don't want to sleep with women, but also they aren't necessarily pursuing, like, increased meditative enlightenment. They're just kind of
then I suppose
chilling,
find something that stands on its own. So, like, for you, that's surfing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need to get better at surfing for surfing to be valuable to you. For some people, it's like, it's playing music or listening to music. Maybe the travel will spark something inside of you. You're saying you just feel kind of bored right now.
No zest for life.
Yes. What I would advise you is to sign up, and you did with this travel thing. It doesn't need to be the last one, but it you know, for a number of activities that you've heard people say are valuable in and of themselves. And so common ones are like surfing, music, dancing, art. Some people even just like business. Some people like relationships with other people. Some people like trying to have sex. Some people, you know, I don't think that one lasts for a very long time, but
I pursued it for its joy in the moment at the time.
Yeah. But, and give them a try and see if any of those shake the boredom and you find valuable in and of themselves. And so I think it's really good that you have this trip coming up because it's going to give you an opportunity to try a bunch of different things. And you'll probably find a bunch of things you hate, like maybe even French food, all that bread.
Definitely English food.
Yeah. But that would be my recommendation.
What do you do in general if you just have, if you're like just apathies, you're just meh, just apathy is your go-to and it's not a pleasant experience for you?
It's tough, man, because I love apathy.
That's what I'm saying. Imagine that it's not. Like, imagine you.
It's tough. It's really tough for me to sink into because I've cared too much. And so apathy is a relief oftentimes for me.
I know. That's why I'm saying, I feel like sometimes that's the place that people come from that's foreign to you, but that happens, which is like, I wish I cared about something. I wish I did more.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think emotional mastery I've seen has affected people in this particular one. It didn't really do it for me. But apathy is often a guard against intense feeling, you know, like because the feelings
or
are
a failure because, or not being good enough.
Exactly. Because the fear is so overwhelming. I don't give a shit because it makes me feel so good. I don't give a shit because it makes me feel so nervous or whatever. I don't care. So some of the meditations in week two of emotional mastery are very helpful. I think there's particularly an apathy meditation. And in those cases, I do think some sort of inner exploration, because I no longer believe that there are untraumatized, negatively apathetic people. I think you might have like monks who appear apathetic, but in like a pleasant way. But when there's that just dullness, I'm like, that's a lowering of the volume on life.
No, I agree. That's what I wanted to bring it up is I think that for you or I, who were so achievement focused for so long,
to not give a shit is like such a sigh of relief, yeah.
Yes, but then there's the person, I mean, there's just a lot of the flip side of where we've gotten to that I think, like apathy in a way that is destructive. Negative, yeah. Or we're like, oh yeah, now we play video games because for a decade I didn't read a book unless it was self-improvement and I didn't do an activity unless it was going to make tomorrow's Ben better than yesterday's Ben. And so it's like the ability to play video games for 3 hours is such a stark difference from doing that for a decade. But then you do get, when I was doing a video on video game addiction, I didn't end up making it. You get guys who are,
I was
addicted in high school. I broke the addiction. I managed to get into a community college and then I got sucked back in and I play 16 hours a day. I literally would blow off family dinner to do it. I have no friends. Friends would come over and they would try to talk to me, but I would not look away from the computer screen. And so I lost all my friends and now I'm broke. My parents just kicked me out of the house because they got tired of playing for the internet. I'm homeless and I'm a video game addict. It's like, oh yeah, there is this other end of the spectrum where it's not just, hey, if you like video games because they're fun, fucking play them as much as you want. It's like, that's good advice for you, Charlie Hooper, but there is a destructive.
I think explore the apathy then. And so the kind of the exercise is, which you can do on your own or you can join the course, but it's just a guided meditation in this particular case is, what does apathy feel like inside of you? And it takes time to actually notice it. And it might feel like an emptiness. It might feel like a pain in a particular area. And you allow that by noticing the sensation or the thoughts that arise, you kind of allow them to continue to play. So what apathy can sometimes be is it's like it's a pause or a mute on a negative feeling. And that emptiness might be fucking horrible. And on the other side of that, if you were to go into it, you might just burst into tears at how many things you're upset about, you know. So this meditation in allowing you to sink into the feeling, allow it to evolve, move inside of you. You feel the emptiness shift. You feel like now have thoughts in your head or something somebody say to you, you'll never amount to anything and you hear echoes. The guided meditation takes you through that, but you can start to do it yourself. So you feel the apathy, feel the sensations, thoughts, sounds, images that arise. Be with them, hang out with them, see if they move. And then if you feel stuck, you can say, when have I felt this particular sensation before? So it might be like a pain in your heart. When have I felt this earlier in my life? And you can continue to do that all the way back to, you know, when was the first time and see what comes up. And oftentimes what apathy is it's like a jam, like all emotions can be like a jam in the flow and this can unlock it. And then you're dealing with sadness, which is an improvement, you know what I mean? Or longing or frustration or anger. But all of a sudden you've got that like vitality is coming back to you. There's things that you hate. There's things that you like. And you'll maybe even have more of a direction from it. So that's, I think, an approach that can be helpful. Cool.
That was the last one.
All right. We got patrons.
Yep.
What do we got?
So we're going to talk about setting boundaries with work tasks. We're going to talk about if your charisma is a little too high energy. And then we're going to talk about being authentic versus making an effort to fit in.
Okay. Cool. That's what we got on Patreon and many more. So if you guys want to check that out, every single dollar amount gets you access to basically an additional podcast that we do determined by you, the viewers and listeners. So if you want to do that, it helps us keep going. Go straight to Justin's pocket. And we'll be over there in a moment. Peace out.